Director Spike Jonze's last feature was Adaptation, about a screenwriter driven to madness when he attempts to turn a book into a film. Now Jonze has done an adaptation of his own, turning Maurice Sendak's wildly popular children's book, Where the Wild Things Are, into a live-action movie. So, how did he do? Our film critic David Edelstein has this review.
What a task director Spike Jonze has set for himself, adapting Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are. Sendak's illustrated children's story is one of the few things I can confidently call perfect. It's the tale of a boy's tantrum and his fed-up mother's rejection of him, bed without supper. And it's the tale of the dream that transports him over the sea in his wolf pajamas to a land of monsters that crown him king and help him act out all his rowdy infantile impulses, until the rage goes out of his system and he longs to return home. Sendak's huge creatures are on the border between stuffed animal cuddlesome and mythically grotesque, perfect mascots for Sendak, whose fantasies are always double-edged. They can liberate you or consume you. Jonze's film is a different animal than Sendak's. Its wild things are more domesticated, and its characters come with a backstory, to my mind, one that spells things out too much. Max is a lonely casualty of his parents' divorce, who freaks out when he sees his mom, played by Catherine Keener, getting frisky with a date. One alteration by Jonze and co-screenwriter Dave Eggers is unpardonable. Max dashes out of the house instead of getting sent to bed without supper, so there are no bedroom walls melting away and forest rolling in, one of the book's most archetypal images. But once Max is in a boat being tossed on the waves, Jonze's vision begins to cast a spell all its own. Max is played by a kid with the name Max Records, who has a mop of hair and a sweet face, but is also petulant and edgy. It's an uningratiating performance that ends up totally winning. Jonze and Eggers' most agreeable innovation is turning Sendak's rather anonymous beasts into complex and conflicted personalities. They sit around quarreling, smashing things, staring into space, and wishing for a leader. And then comes little Max, who says he's a king from a distant land, to keep them from devouring him. If you've seen the previews, you know the setting is real. The rocky coast of Australia, a burned forest, a desert, and the creatures decidedly unreal. Giant puppets, furry or feathered, modeled on Sendak's drawings. Instead of being bombarded by computer illusions, we're allowed to suspend our disbelief and bring our own imaginations into play. For all the artfulness, the feel is rough-hewn. It's a fabulous treehouse of a movie. There is computer animation, but it's largely used for the creature's expressions, and I've rarely seen facial movements so evocative. Jonze rehearsed the voice actors together instead of taping them separately, as in most animated films, and they're like a crack repertory company. Chief among them is James Gandolfini, who has tender, plaintive cadences, all New Jersey gangster expunged, as Carol, the tempestuous lummox. Carol needs a king, a firm dad, to direct his wayward energies. When he and Max walk in the desert, they bond over childhood anxieties as few characters in movies.
Well, this part of your kingdom's not so good.
Why?
Well, look, this used to be all rock, and now it's sand, and then one day it's going to be dust, and then the whole island will be dust, and then I don't even know what comes after dust.
Carol.
Mm-hmm?
Did you know the sun was going to die?
What? I never heard that. Oh, come on. That can't happen. I mean, you're the king. Look at me. I'm big. How could guys like us worry about a tiny little thing like the sun? Huh?
That gives you a sense of how soft the movie is. And I'm of two minds about that. But then again, this isn't Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are, and the creatures aren't just projections of Max's id. There's been a lot of talk about whether the film is too scary for little kids, to which Sendak crustily responded at a press conference, "Let 'em wet their pants." I think the scary charge is nonsense, though. Kids like to be scared, and these wild things in the end are human, a family in all its imperfections, which is what this boy needs. Unlike the childish carnivores of Sendak's book, these movie beasts just wouldn't eat their own.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.
You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I am Ira Flatow. Up next, the latest on a mysterious illness called chronic fatigue syndrome. Researchers have been studying people who've been diagnosed with it, trying to figure out what might be causing their symptoms, which range from joint pain, debilitating fatigue, and inflammation. A team of researchers reports that they've hit on something. Out of 101 people diagnosed with chronic fatigue, 67% of them had a specific virus in their blood, a virus called XMRV, and just 4% or so of healthy volunteers had the virus in their blood. Scientists have known about the virus for a while. It's been implicated in other diseases. Joining me now to talk more about this work published in the journal Science is John Coffin, professor of molecular biology and microbiology at Tufts University in Boston. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Coffin.
Good afternoon, Ira. Thank you.
So this is a pretty good indication, a pretty good connection.
For a first report, it's very good. In fact, there's still a lot of work to be done to firmly establish a causal relationship between the virus and the disease, but it's a very, very interesting first step.
Well, this would also vindicate a lot of people who have chronic fatigue syndrome, who have, you know, been abused by people who think it's all in your head, you've got something else, it's just a syndrome, there's no real cause to it, things like that.
I would imagine that's the case, yes.
Mm-hmm. And so how did you go about, what was your motivation for looking for this viral connection?
I have to make one thing very clear right here. The work we're discussing was not mine. Mm-hmm. It was done by other groups. I'm a very interested observer and chronicler of their work, mm-hmm. and I had worked on this virus many years ago when we thought it was just a mouse virus.
Mm-hmm.
The people that did work on it, my understanding is that their motivation was based on a correlation that had been previously reported, this virus and a certain specific mutation in individuals with prostate cancer in a gene called RNase-L.
Mm-hmm. How many more people would need to be studied, do you think? You need a much larger study to make a better, more cementable?
Well, we certainly need a much larger study, but that's absolutely called for. We don't know very much about the association except for the 101 people you just mentioned. And my understanding is there's over 1 million people diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome or suspected to have chronic fatigue syndrome in the United States alone.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible there are multiple diseases that have very similar symptoms? And there's all kinds of things that are possible here that we just haven't sorted out yet.
Is it possible that the virus is a red herring in the way? And I mean by that people with chronic fatigue may have some other problem that leaves them susceptible to getting this virus.
That's entirely possible, and this all needs to be sorted out, and I think it will be sorted out very quickly, probably within the next few months.
Where do you find the virus in the body?
The virus, so far, has been found in white blood cells, principally, and it's been possible by the groups that were doing this to actually isolate and grow virus from those cells and to grow it in new cells of the same type from healthy donors.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know. It's been isolated from those cells because those are, in a sense, the easiest cells to look at. You can just take some blood and get them out of it. We don't know what other cells it is and isn't in infected individuals at this point.
Mm-hmm. And the virus has been implicated in other diseases.
There's an implication of prostate cancer. There was a paper that appeared about a month or so ago providing a somewhat less striking, about a 25% incidence of the virus in cases of prostate cancer.
Mm-hmm. And where do we know where it comes from?
Well, it almost has to come from mice. It's very, very closely related to what's called an endogenous virus of mice. An endogenous virus is a retrovirus that's inherited in the DNA, in the germline of its host. And we have been studying, this is a virus we've been studying for over 25 years now in mice, never thinking that it might in fact also be in humans.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Also, you can tweet us at SciFry. In the 101 patients, or in the total study of all the patients, were they split equally among different ages, or did you find that the virus was in older or younger people, or certain people of certain age?
I don't believe, again, it wasn't my study. Mm-hmm. My understanding is there wasn't any obvious connection of that sort, but I don't know that for sure, I have to admit.
Is there any way to get rid of this virus once it's in your
probably
bloodstream?
Probably not. A retrovirus like HIV is also a retrovirus, and there's no way to get rid of HIV that we know of, despite the fact that we've tried very, very hard over many years to do so. HIV infection can be suppressed, and people can be relieved of the symptoms of the disease for very long periods of time, but nobody, as far as we know, has ever really been proven to be cured of the infection, and I suspect the same thing would prove to be true of this virus as well.
Mm-hmm. You write in an article, or I'm going to quote for an article from Science Express, that another notable feature of XMRV is that the frequency of infection in non-disease controls is remarkably high, about 4%.
Right.
In both normal individuals from the same geographic region as infected patients. It would mean that perhaps, it says, 10 million people in the U.S. and hundreds of millions worldwide are infected with this virus.
That's the implication. That's, again, a very initial study on just a few people, and one needs to get a much larger sample and some real demographics and so on to establish those numbers. But that's certainly what that would imply as we look at the numbers. If we take those numbers at face value right now, mm-hmm. that would be about 10 times the number of people in the United States who are infected with HIV, for mm-hmm. example.
Mm-hmm. Are you being inundated with people, or do you feel that people are going to want to be tested now?
I've gotten a few emails. I should make it very clear that there are no clinically approved diagnostic tests based on this at present, and it will be some time before such tests are available. Any tests that are being done now are being done purely with research tools, most of which were originally developed to study the mouse virus, as I was talking about.
Mm-hmm. And we don't know how the virus is spread.
We have no idea how the virus is spread right now.
But we know that it's in mice.
It is in mice. All mice carry some virus like it in their DNA, and some. At least in laboratory mice, some express it as infectious virus. And it almost certainly, as I said, came from mice originally. How it mm-hmm. got from mice to humans, again, we have no idea yet.
Let me get a phone call or two in here. Let's go to Bobby in San Francisco. Hi, Bobby.
Hi. Really enjoy your program, Ira. I've had chronic fatigue syndrome now since my 40s. I'm 72. And I wonder if the individual you're talking to has heard of the work of Dr. Nancy Klimas, K-L-I-M-A-S, or the recent studies which found over 350 genetic expression anomalies in chronic fatigue patient syndromes. Oh, pardon me if I'm confused a little bit there.
Okay.
I haven't heard of that work specifically, no. It certainly wouldn't surprise me to hear that there's a lot of differences in gene expression in patients.
The fact that this is a retrovirus. What does that say to you?
The fact that it's a retrovirus means it's a virus that replicates in a very specific way by converting its genome RNA to DNA and causing that DNA to be integrated in with the cellular genome to become essentially a normal cellular gene, and then that gene directs the production of more virus. There are many different types of retroviruses. HIV is one. There's a virus called human T-cell leukemia virus, which is responsible for some cases of leukemia and lymphoma in humans. Mm-hmm. And then there's a very large number of other viruses in this general group.
Can you explain the nomenclature XMRV to describe this?
X comes from xenotropic. It's a slightly confusing designation. What it means is that the virus is found as an endogenous virus, meaning it's in the germline of its host, in this case mice, but it can't. But if you take the virus out of the germline and take the DNA out and make virus out of it, that virus will not infect mice, and therefore, but it will infect humans and many other species of animals, but not mice. And the reason for that is that mice, after the virus got into the germline of mice, after which is probably around a million years ago or so, the mice became resistant to it by accumulating a mutation, which made them no longer able to be infected by that virus. Mm-hmm.
So it worked its way into the human population?
And somehow it's worked its way into the human population.
Mm-hmm. So we think it's much more prevalent than we might think otherwise?
Well, the estimated prevalence right now is that 4% number that we were discussing earlier. Whether there's more than that, how real that number is,
yeah,
and so on, we just have to find out. Good studies have to be done to establish that.
All right, Dr. Coffin, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us.
You're very welcome.
Good luck to you. John Coffin, professor of molecular biology and microbiology at Tufts University in Boston and author of A New Virus for Old Diseases. It's Science Express paper.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. This year, two Florida high school football teams engaged in a battle, if you can call it that. The final score was 82-0. A few weeks later, the final score in another Florida game was 91-0. Now, these may be extreme examples, but every week in nearly every state, teams win by 50 or 60 points. The charge of poor sportsmanship inevitably follows. Today, as part of our series Friday Night Lives, NPR's Mike Pesca reports on the blowout.
A coach's halftime speech is a chance to reset strategy, buck up spirits. If you're desperate, linger on the details of how your opponents put on their pants. What to do then if you were John Petrie of Plainville, Kansas, a couple of seasons back, when in a game against Smith Center, you found your team down 72-0 in the first quarter? The first quarter. Petrie just reached for a little perspective.
You know, our kids gave it all they had, and just things snowballed on us. And, you know, what do you say to kids in the locker room is, you know, basically, if this is the worst thing that you ever have to go through, you're doing pretty good in life.
With the loss came media attention. What kind of monster would commit such a slaughter? New York Times reporter Joe Drape saw the score and asked the same question. The answer wound up being the book Our Boys, A Perfect Season on the Plains with the Smith Center Redmen. Drape found Smith Center's coach, Roger Barda, to actually be the quintessential sportsman.
He and I have talked about this. He's very sensitive. He was one coach of the year, and it was a big honor, but a guy came up to him and said, you know, you're the jerk who ran up the score. And, you know, if you go back and look at the YouTube, it was just a calamity of errors. I mean, there's fumbles returned. There's interceptions returned. He called up to the booth and had his athletic director, Greg Holman, he said, call the state of Kansas because this is getting out of hand and they need to put the 40-point rule in.
The 40-point rule mandates that when a team goes up big, the officials revert to a running clock, which significantly shortens the game and the damage. A lot of states use this because coaches feel it allows for real football to be played, just less of it. Coaches with big leads usually substitute in their second and third stringers, and they hate to tell them not to try hard. And even coaches on the losing side feel humiliated if their opponents simply kneel down on offense.
There is an art, I guess, to winning big.
Kurt Voigt has covered high school football for the Morning News in Northwest Arkansas for 15 years.
I think there's little things you can do to kind of endear goodwill from the losing coaches.
One such coach, Springdale's Gus Malzahn, won the state championship in 2005 with an offense so dominant that the professionals began to take notes. Malzahn is one of the fathers of the Wildcat, the NFL's latest trend du jour. Voigt's book about that season, Year of the Dog, details the master tactician Malzahn's methods of not scoring.
They broke every record they could for, you know, scoring in the state's largest classification. And what really made it amazing was They never scored more than 56 points in a game that season. There were some games they could have scored 100 very easily.
The state of Connecticut is not content to allow coaches to police themselves. They impose an automatic suspension on the coach of a team that wins by more than 50 points. Paul Hoey oversees football for the Connecticut Interscholastic Athletic Conference. When the rule passed, he heard his coach's complaints.
What are we doing? It's not the nature of football. They should be allowed to play. They should be allowed to score. We really believe that coaches need to understand that it is not right and that there are things that they can do, play a full game, but not run the score out of sight.
Since the rule was passed, blowouts, as Connecticut defines them, dropped from 27 a year to 3 in the last 2 years combined. And two of those three winning and therefore losing head coaches successfully appealed their suspensions. When coaches from outside Connecticut are told of the rule, a pained look is sure to follow. It seems to contradict what they preach in practice. Work hard on every down and own your failures. Still, there is something in the nature of a football blowout worse than any sport that seems so agonizing. Joe Drape has a theory.
Football blowouts seem to be more methodical. You know, there's the play stops, everybody goes back to the huddle, another play's run, you know. It just seems to be slower torture.
Perhaps no one withstood a single quarter of torture worse than John Petrie in Plainville's loss to Smith Center. And while Petrie regards it as a learning experience, it should be noted that Plainville and Petrie's new team, Trago High, will be moving to eight-man football next year. So the learning process can continue without Smith Center on the schedule. Mike Pesca, NPR News.
This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later, we'll be talking about climate change policy. But first, anyone ever tell you that you're living in a bubble? You know, not that kind of bubble. Well, the truth is, we all live in sort of a bubble, a huge bubble created by the sun called the heliosphere. It's a space carved out around our solar system by the solar wind, a stream of gas blowing out from the sun at millions of miles per hour into space in all directions and all the time. But eventually, that solar wind slows down, our protective bubble ends, and the rest of the galaxy begins. And last year, around this time, NASA sent up a spacecraft called the Interstellar Boundary Explorer, the IBEX, to investigate what's going on at those outer limits where the heliosphere meets that galaxy. And now the results are in, published this week in the journal Science, with some very unexpected twists for scientists. Our next guest is here to talk about us and walk us through the findings. And if you'd like to talk about it, our number is 1-800-989-8255. Excuse me, 1-800-989-TALK. And you can tweet us at SciFry. David McComas is the principal investigator for NASA's Interstellar Boundary Explorer spacecraft. The IBEX is also assistant vice president of the Space Science and Engineering Division at Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio, Texas. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. Great to talk to you again.
Thank you. Let's step back for a minute and talk about the heliosphere in general. Why is it there and what does it do for us?
Okay, well, actually, your summary was very good. The heliosphere is really there because we have a sun with a very hot atmosphere called the corona that boils off into space all the time. And that boiling off corona produces a wind that we call the solar wind of hot ionized gas that flows out a million miles an hour and inflates this bubble in space. And inside the bubble, the heliosphere, is basically material from the sun. Outside of the bubble and providing pressure from the outside trying to squeeze it in is material from the rest of the galaxy.
Mm-hmm. And what does this IBEX spacecraft do?
So IBEX, the Interstellar Boundary Explorer, actually measures neutral particles, neutral atoms, single atoms, that come propagating in from the outer reaches of the heliosphere. It's about 10 billion miles, and these particles come in over the course of many months to a year, depending on their speed. And they're produced in this interaction region near the boundary mm-hmm. between our heliosphere and the rest of the galaxy. And these neutral particles are produced, they're neutralized there, and then they can cross magnetic fields all the way back into Earth orbit. IBEX is in a high-altitude Earth orbit that goes almost out to the moon, and it looks out and sees these particles coming in from mm-hmm. distant space.
So IBEX can scan the sky in all directions and then make a map of these particles.
Yes, it actually took us 6 months to make the map. We used the spinning of the spacecraft and the fact that we have to keep repointing the solar panels at the sun over the course of 6 months to view the entire sky.
And you saw something unusual, what you've been describing as this ribbon that would go around the whole map here.
Yeah, unusual is maybe not a big enough word. It's really shocking. We expected to see, based on theories and models, we expected to see variations in the number of particles or the flux of particles coming in from these outer reaches, and we expected those variations to be relatively small and to tens of percent and to vary over very large angular ranges. And instead, what we saw was a very narrow structure that we call a ribbon, where the fluxes, the number of particles coming in, are two or three times that of any other part of the sky.
Do you know why that is?
We don't really know why that is. The theories and models include a lot of the effects that we thought were important out there. There were no predictions of a narrow structure like this ribbon. But we have learned that the ribbon appears to line up with the direction in space where the external magnetic field, the field outside of our heliosphere in the local interstellar medium, where it basically drapes around and squeezes hardest on our heliosphere. And so through some as-yet unidentified physical process, there seems to be a connection between those two things.
As-yet unidentified physical object.
Process. I mean, we know there's a correlation between the two.
Yeah.
This interstellar magnetic field was determined based on other independent observations,
right.
And we basically see this ribbon, and when you say, well, okay, what orders the ribbon, what lines up with the orientation of this ribbon, it's this external magnetic field. So somehow it's squeezing on the heliosphere causes something to happen where we collect two or three times more particles right along this narrow structure than anywhere else.
So these particles are coming in from outer space. If I could draw myself a picture, they're coming in from outer space, and some process is making them sort of line up in a narrow channel.
Right. Probably the source is actually higher density out there. Most likely, there's the ribbon of particles coming in is actually reflecting a ribbon of high density out at the interaction.
Mm-hmm. And where are the particles coming from? Any one place in space, or just from out there?
Well, the solar wind, as it expands out and it expands out to about 10 billion miles, it goes through a shock, something we call the termination shock, where it slows down and starts to turn around and get diverted away from the interstellar material. In the space between that shock and the boundary of the heliosphere, the gas becomes heated and becomes slower. And that's the region that these neutral particles are produced and come radiating back in towards us from.
Mm-hmm. I noticed in reading your paper and watching your news conference on this that you showed where the two Voyager spacecraft are located, one in and right out there, right in the middle of this ribbon, and they were launched in the 70s, and they totally missed it, it seems.
Yeah, the Voyagers are just great spacecraft.
They're still working?
Still working, and they're returning great observations, and we know a lot about this interaction region at the two locations of the Voyagers, and that was part of what was so shocking to us. We thought we knew a lot more because we have these good local measurements from these two spacecraft, and then as we started to build up the image of the sky, we went, wow, look at that. The most interesting, surprising thing in the whole sky actually kind of snakes between the two, and both of the Voyagers miss it.
Wow. And that's because it's like having just a couple of outposts. Like.
Yeah, the analogy that we like to use is it's a little bit like having two weather stations on the ground. You know, maybe you have one in San Antonio where I live, and maybe you have one in New Orleans. But you can have a hurricane come through and hit Houston and not necessarily measure it in either one of those two locations. Mm. So IBEX is very much like having a weather satellite, finally, where you can look down on the weather fronts and see the whole global picture. Mm-hmm. Instead of just having the local measurements at your weather stations.
Now, you were talking about how this was collecting data over a six-month period. Does the ribbon change shape over that period of time?
And that's a great question. It takes us 6 months to make the full image because of how the spacecraft makes it. We are now collecting observations in the second sky map, And while we haven't published those results yet, what we have said about it is that the ribbon is still there, but that there appears there may be some variations from 1 6-month to the next 6 months.
Hmm. And why would our current theories about how our galaxies interact with the universe, why would they not predict this ribboning effect? What do we have to change now about how we look at our own galaxy, solar system?
If I knew the answer to that, I'd be writing that paper today. There's really something very fundamental in this interaction. Something in, you know, we have a lot of physics in these models and simulations. There's really something very fundamental that we're missing. There's a piece that we haven't included that we haven't understood yet, and the community as a whole is rushing like crazy now to try to figure that out.
Could it be something as mysterious as the dark energy out there? Dark matter? Dark energy?
It's probably not related to that. It probably has to do with how ionized particles collect in regions and how you can get higher density regions in some places than others, maybe how the magnetic field is configured. It's probably not related to dark energy. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, as a scientist, I have to tell you that until we understand something, it's very important for us to sort of leave as many options open as possible. Mm-hmm. Sometimes these things are really surprising.
Let's go to Sue in Port Charlotte. Hi, Sue.
Hi.
Hi there.
My question is, I'm not sure, I don't know where your funding comes from, whether it's private funding or from the government, but I'm wondering... Also, from the minute I was speaking just a little while ago about the moon and landing...
So I'm running out of time. You got to get your question in.
My question is there some kind of positive need for this as far as humanity goes? Will this help humanity in some way on the whole?
Okay, so, Sue, that's a great question. So this boundary, this interstellar boundary, actually is a very important region for us. It provides protection from the vast majority of the cosmic radiation, the galactic cosmic rays that are running around outside in the rest of the galaxy. And for example, about 90% of the galactic cosmic rays at 100 million electron volts, which is a measure of energy, about 90% of those are actually shielded out by this interaction region. That interaction region has probably changed over time and will probably change again in the future as we go through different exterior conditions. And only by understanding it can we understand how those variations have happened and are likely to happen going forward. Right now we're at a point where the galactic cosmic rays are at about the highest level that we've measured since the space age, and they've been going up because we're in a very extended solar minimum. Understanding this interaction will help us understand whether we can do manned space flights, for example, further out in the solar system and tolerate the radiation from the galactic cosmic rays.
Okay, Sue?
Cancer at all? I mean, is that part of the issue?
What's that?
Is it a cause for cancer?
I'm not sure what that meant.
Cause for cancer on the face of the Earth in humans? No, I don't think so. This is more radiation out in space for manned space flight.
And that is a big, thank you, Sue, that is a big problem for going out there in space, is it not?
Yeah, right. That's right. I mean, one of the big things that you have to deal with is how much radiation your astronauts can have.
Well, Dr. McComas, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Ira.
Dave McComas is the principal investigator for the NASA IBEX spacecraft and assistant vice president of the Space Science and Engineering Division at Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio, Texas. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to change direction and talk about climate change. The UN Summit on Climate Change is set to take place in Copenhagen, if you wish. We'll come back and talk about what to expect is going to happen at that meeting. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News. Up next, the Kids Science Challenge. Cool science projects for elementary school kids. All they have to do is dream up a problem that they want to solve with science. Kids get a little guidance on the categories because they've limited the categories, and it's easy. We don't want to choose everything. They can choose from bio-inspired design, detective science, or sports on Mars. Are you wondering how your kids can get involved? There is still plenty of time for them to enter, and my next guest is here to talk about it. I'm sure he's a well-known voice to you. Jim Metzner, executive producer of the Kids Science Challenge, is also Pulse of the Planet producer. Welcome to Science Friday, Jim.
Hi, Ira.
Good to have you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us about the history of this contest.
Well, we realized some years ago that we were reaching a lot of people on Pulse of the Planet, about 900,000 adults, 18 or plus over, but not many kids. And our country, as your listeners are probably well aware of, is not doing so great in the education, in the science education department, certainly not in the younger grades. And so we were trying to put together a program with the help of the National Science Foundation that would turn kids onto science and just say that science is not only meaningful, it's interesting, it's fun.
Mm-hmm. And so what does it entail to enter the contest here?
Well, you've got to be a third to sixth grader.
Yeah.
And you can enter individually or you can enter in a team. A lot of kids enter in after-school groups. We work with 4-H and Girl Scouts and other after-school groups, but it can be just a homeschooler. Anyone can really enter. And you go to our website, which is kidsciencechallenge.com, kidsciencechallenge.com. And you'll see there's a wealth of information there about the three subjects that you just mentioned. And you'll learn what bio-inspired designs are, how there are many things in nature that we take for granted. Velcro, for one, is a popular example that comes actually from an idea that was inspired by something in nature, in this case a seed burr that got stuck to somebody's sock. And you can come up with an idea for a sport on Mars, taking into account that Mars has very different conditions than Earth does. In particular, its air pressure is kind of low and the gravity is low, and so the sport has to work on Mars. And then come up with an idea for a mystery that you make up, either a real life or a made-up mystery, using the forensic techniques, the detective science techniques that you would learn on our site. And you'd learn about Mars on our site, and you'd learn about all of these, what bio-inspired design means. You come up with an idea, you get your parental permission is, of course, required, and you can enter online, and you can enter by faxing it or mailing it in, and then one of the cool things is the first 1,000 kids who enter get a free, and the whole thing is free, by the way, I should have said that right off the bat. It's all free, and the first 1,000 kids who enter get a free, wonderful science activity kit as well.
Wow. So there's a lot of free stuff going on there. Will kids get help with these ideas? Are they allowed to ask for help?
Well, yeah. There are a couple of ways that they can. One way is they can actually ask the scientists themselves. We have a partner. They'll see the pathway to the partner right on our site. It's called Woogie World. And through their help, kids can actually ask questions of the scientists. And the thing that kind of blew my mind, and we're in the second year of the competition, Ira. We did it last year, and we had a wonderful response. This year, with this new partner, we had in less than a week, 1,000 kids asking questions to our scientists, which was a real surprise to us. We did not expect that many kids to be asking questions, which it's a wonderful surprise, but we were scrambling a bit to get all the responses to that, I can assure you. So that's one way. And the scientists do respond, and so, you know, the questions run the gamut.
Yeah. Well, what happens when they get chosen, their idea gets chosen?
Well, that's the coolest thing about the kids' science. We have prizes, too. But the coolest prize is that you get to collaborate with the scientists. You get the all-expense-paid trip to collaborate with the scientists and see your idea become real. So last year, for example, we had a skateboard competition. Some young lady who won, designed the skateboard, got to visit the skateboard engineers and actually got to make the skateboard that she had dreamed up.
Wow.
And then they get prizes on top of that. For Sports on Mars, it's a trip to space camp for the bioengineered designs. It's a behind-the-scenes trip to the San Diego Zoo. And for the detective science, it's a Pali adventure camp, week at an adventure camp.
So these don't have to be really elaborate science fair, geeky sort of things.
Well, this is a competition for the kids who aren't in the fold. The non-science, you know, if you're a true blue science believer, by all means, we'd love to have you. But, for example, a lot of our winners last year were not the real science geeks, per se. They just came up with a great idea. Lindsay Carnes, the young lady I was just mentioning about, not only wasn't a quote-unquote science kid, but she'd never been on a skateboard in her life. She just happened to come up with a terrific idea.
There was another one. There was another one I read about that was about an interesting tongue depressor.
Yeah, last year we had a flavor science category, and some kids, they were a team, and they called the teams all named themselves, and they called themselves the Candy Doctors. They're from Virginia Beach, Virginia, and they came up with a fabulous idea to. When you go to the doctor, you instead of having it be a wooden thing you stick in your mouth, why not have it be a candy-flavored tongue depressor? And they did. They got to go to, in this case, Cadbury Chocolates. The scientist was the chief flavorist at Cadbury, and they made their prototype tongue depressor.
Wow. Isn't that cool? Not sure. Why throw out a wooden stick? If you can go home with something to eat instead of the lollipop, you get the tongue depressor.
That's what the candy doctor said, and they were right. And it was, sure, it's actually a fabulous idea. And also, to answer your question before as to what helped, there's lots of downloadable activities. Even if you don't want to enter the competition, which is fine, you can learn about these things, and you can do, we have great downloadable activities and lots of videos and games, and they're all instructive, so you learn viscerally what this subject is about. And then if you want to enter the competition, great, we'd love to have it. And then the kids can send in drawings. We put the drawings up in the gallery, and then the kids get to vote themselves even after the competition is over. We have Kids' Choice Awards where the kids vote for what they think is the coolest idea.
And when does the competition end, when the entry period end? How long do they have for that?
Well, the kids have from now, which started on October 1st, and we still have plenty of active people are entering for sure, but there's still plenty of kits left, don't worry. And it goes until February 28th, the end of February 2010. So you've got some time to think one up. And you mentioned science fairs. We think it's a great opportunity for kids to not only come up with an idea for us, but then use that idea as a springboard for a science fair project, and then we welcome the kids to send in their science fair projects, and we'll put those pictures of their science fair projects up on our website, too.
Well, good luck to you, Jim, and good luck to all the kids out there who are listening. I hope you get 2,000 entries this week.
Ira, thanks. It's kidsciencechallenge.com, and we welcome to receive entries from your listeners.
You're welcome. Jim Metzner, executive producer of the Kids Science Challenge, and you know him from Pulse of the Planet. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today, as always, from NPR librarian Kim Oleski. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we're podcasting and folks still hanging out in Second Life all week and blogging and Twittering and tweeting. Also, if you're in New York, I'll be interviewing Eric Kandel at the New School. He is a Nobel Prize-winning neurologist. We'll talk about his life at the New School over there. And you can click on the face-to-face, Science Face-to-Face on our website. Go to sciencefriday.com. for details on that, and a live podcast, a live webcast, video webcast that you can watch. Have a great week. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
Yesterday, the investment bank Goldman Sachs announced its third quarter profits, a whopping $3.2 billion. Commentator and economist Russ Roberts is not impressed.
Should we care about Goldman's profits and compensation? It's pretty gauche when your take-home pay is millions of dollars while some of your neighbors can't find work. But is it wrong? Is it something those of us on the outside should care about? Normally, I'd say it's nobody's business. What people get paid is best left to the marketplace. But Goldman Sachs is different because those of us on the outside are really on the inside. Goldman Sachs was propped up with our money, not the money they took directly from the government and paid back, the money that AIG gave them that really came from the taxpayer. Goldman Sachs being proud of their performance this year is like the Harlem Globetrotters bragging that they went undefeated. It's not really a normal competition. Goldman Sachs played the same game as Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. They made lousy investments financed with borrowed money. When the assets fell in value, Bear and Lehman died. They were reckless with other people's money. But Goldman Sachs is still here. Why? Part of the reason is that maybe they took a little less risk and maybe hedged against that risk a little better. But part of the reason Goldman lives and thrives is that the government bailed out AIG. Almost $13 billion of the money the government sent to AIG went out the door and over to Goldman. This money included loans and insurance Goldman bought on its bad bets. Some of that insurance turned out to be a bad bet too, but Goldman didn't bear the cost. The taxpayers did. Part of the reason Goldman and other Wall Street firms made so many bad bets is they knew they might be rescued. And most of the time, they were. The rescue of large financial institutions is justified by policymakers as a way to save the system and protect Main Street from a tsunami of financial instability. But capitalism is a profit and loss system. The profits encourage risk-taking. The losses encourage prudence. If the taxpayer almost always eats the losses for the losers, you don't have capitalism. You have crony capitalism. The latest rescue of Wall Street has taken hundreds of billions of dollars from average Americans and given that money to some of the richest people in human history, people who made bad bets and should have taken enormous losses. Instead, they've been taken care of. Their triumph makes Bernie Madoff look like a small-time operator. The key policymakers, Hank Paulson, Ben Bernanke, and Tim Geithner, have been praised for keeping things afloat. But to what purpose? What's the virtue of saving crony capitalism? Maybe they prevented an even worse recession. There's no way of knowing. But they have deeply damaged both capitalism and democracy. We have a financial system that not only rewards cronies and encourages recklessness, it also funnels precious capital into areas like the housing sector instead of into more productive investments. We have to stop rescuing the reckless. We have to let people who make bad decisions bear the consequences. Profit and loss. The rest of us live that way. Wall Street can too.
Russ Roberts is a professor of economics at George Mason University. He's also a research scholar at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. To comment on this essay, go to the opinion section of npr.org.